Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update, our weekend for the change to daylight saving time. So keep that in mind when you go to bed tonight. Move that clock forward 1 hour. Jeff Wolf is behind the console, Jane Houghton and our producer this morning, and Ron DeSantis is out on the book tour trail. You see, I was going to say campaign trail, but no, he's not campaigning. He's out promoting his book. And where do you think he chose to promote his book yesterday? Iowa. Coincidentally, the first Republican primary state. Coincidentally, a state where Donald Trump will visit to campaign on Monday. So Ron DeSantis was there, and he was somewhat on fire as he addressed a crowd in Davenport, Iowa. And here's Governor Ron DeSantis.
I bring greetings from the free state of Florida. And it's so great to be here. I will send my Florida people who built those bridges in record time, I'll send them to the southern border to do the wall. Just put me in, Coach. Come on, Joe. Let us get it done.
Quite a presentation to those voters in Iowa as he continued.
If you talk to Floridians, there's no drama in our administration. There's no palace intrigue. They basically just sit back and say, okay, what's the governor going to do next? And we roll out and we execute and we do things and we get things done. And in the process, we beat the left day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year.
Now, he's not going unnoticed, of course, by the progressives and, of course, the more liberal media. And one that caught their attention was his comments on the school systems.
We're also leading on ensuring that our school system is focusing on educating our kids, not indoctrinating our kids. It is wrong to tell a second grader that they were born in the wrong body. It is wrong to have gender ideology imposed in our schools. And in Florida, we don't let it happen. We have fought the fight, and we're going to do more.
Yeah, that's Ron DeSantis, and we'll get one more from his campaign portion, and then we've got one from his sit-down Q&A.
And I have to confess that anti-riot legislation I signed earned a public rebuke from the United Nations, which I wear as a badge of honor.
So you get a sense of where he's going. It's kind of Trump. Well, you'll hear how he describes things in a minute. But here's a little earlier when he was doing the sit down and talking about his book and talking about Donald Trump.
He used to say how great of a governor I was, and then I win a big victory, and all of a sudden, you know, he had different opinions. And so you could take that for what it's worth. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think one of the reasons I've been successful as governor is I don't really pay attention to a lot of the background noise. I mean, you know, he's obviously a big fish, but I get attacked all the time from every different angle, and you either put points on the board or you don't. And so I just focus on delivering the wins, and I think we've done a pretty good job of following through on our promises.
And, of course, he has not announced his campaign. The strategy, from what all of the anonymous sources are saying, is that he will kind of low-key it until May. He will take the next 60 days to focus on state affairs with the state legislature. And also there is talk that they would hopefully, for him, get a resolution through the state House and Senate that would allow him to run for president. But if he loses, he would remain governor. He would not have to leave the governorship in order to run for president. Very interesting strategy. So I guess we'll see what happens in May if those anonymous sources are accurate. Well, hold on to your wallets. The president announcing his new budget, and it is a budget buster. It's up in the $6.5 plus trillion range. And it's already being criticized by Republicans and some other folks that are more middle of the road as opposed to just Republican criticism. But got some clips from the president. He was up in Philadelphia to introduce the budget. Now, usually the budgets introduced in D.C. is not a lot of fanfare, but he went up and did kind of a half union rally, half campaign rally, and then maybe threw the budget into the mix. But it was really more of a campaign presentation than a budget presentation. But we've got some clips, and like I said, hold on to your wallet.
The budget I'm introducing today is going to reduce the deficit by nearly $10 billion or $3 billion or $1 trillion over 10 years.
That is President Biden introducing his budget. Here's one that he themed in on during the whole day. He was talking about MAGA Republicans. MAGA, MAGA, MAGA. Here's what he says about the Republicans voting against the Inflation Reduction Act.
The MAGA Republicans want to take away the law. That one of the things they've announced, they want to do away with the Inflation Reduction Act.
Well, yeah, because it's not going to reduce inflation. Have you seen any reduction in inflation recently? Did you fill up your car with gas in the past week or two? That's back up on the rise. Anyway, while he's on the MAGA theme, of course, here's more criticism of their voting record.
MAGA Republicans all voted to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. They voted to get rid of it over 50 times since Barack passed it.
Okay, so now he's talking about MAGA Republicans, talking about the rich. That's his big theme, about taxing the rich.
MAGA Republicans, you know, they don't want things that particularly are going to help working families, like health care, education, public safety, which are going to raise costs on folks. Look, MAGA Republicans also refuse to raise a single penny in new taxes on the wealthiest people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then it's all defunding the police. This is a really good one. Listen to this one carefully.
MAGA Republicans are calling for defunding the police departments and defunding the FBI now. That's a good one. I like that one. Well, guess what? And they refuse to provide funding that's going to keep communities safe and secure.
Okay, so he's talking about the Republicans want to defund the police. I haven't heard that one before. Maybe some reforms at the FBI, but, you know, he'll just make stuff up. Not known for his integrity these days. Now, one of the key elements that is going to impact all of us, you know, one of his major misrepresentations, or I call it a big lie, is the only people that are going to be impacted are people making over $400,000 a year. Well, he's got this little thing going with the capital gains tax. And as you may know, if you sell stock, you are taxed when you sell it. If you buy stock today and you don't sell it for 10 years or you don't sell it for 40 years when you retire, that stock just sits there. It appreciates, hopefully. And when you sell the stock, maybe when you're retired and you're in a lower tax bracket, that's when you pay a capital gains tax. Now, his idea is a little different, and Brett Baer got into it with Chris Van Hollen to try and kind of explain it. We all know Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, who went to the Chris Coons School of How to Be a Puppet for Joe Biden. And here's the exchange between Brett Baer and Chris Van Hollen.
So the taxing on unrealized capital gains doesn't just go after the big time. It goes after people who invest in the market, doesn't it?
Well, this is an idea called mark-to-market, and what it's designed to do is finally bring into some kind of agreement the kind of taxes placed on working people and wages and the taxes that are placed on wealth. And President Biden's been very clear, we shouldn't be disadvantaging people who work every day for a wage, for a paycheck, relative to those who make money off of money.
Senator, unrealized. This is something that is, if the average investor, he hits it big, he buys the stock at $2, it goes to 15, but he's holding onto the stock, he's invested in the company, he's paying on the capital gains on the $13 that picked up. And, you know, what incentive is that to invest in companies, invest in the stock market? That's the question. Unrealized capital gains doesn't just hit the top end, it hits the average investor.
Well, Brett, if you look at the, and I'm sure we're going to get the fine print, there are guardrails that the president puts around that particular piece. over a period of time. So I know we're going to be getting the details from the president on that particular point. I'm looking forward to getting them.
We'll get the details. In other words, they haven't figured out how they're going to pull that one off. I love that guy. To hear the long pause when Brett asked him about it, and well, we'll be getting the details. So, boy. Well, Stephen Moore was a former Trump administration economic advisor, and here's how he looks at the capital gains tax.
For the first time, I think, in history of the country, Joe Biden wants to tax unrealized capital gains. That is, if you own stock and it rises in value, the Biden administration wants to tax you even though you haven't sold it.
Can you believe that? Now, if you're going to get taxed, you know how stocks go up and down. You know how they've all gone down since the Biden administration has been in office. So I figured it out. Here's the strategy. Since the current plan is that you're taxed when you sell the stock, and you're taxed on the gain when you sell the stock. All right, that's how it works now. But in the Biden economy, nobody's getting capital gains. They're getting capital losses. So if you tax the losses when you sell your stock because the market's so far down, they're not going to raise any revenue. So I guess the plan is tax them as it goes up every year. The other half of this equation is if you're taxing it on capital gains during the year, even though you hold the stock, you're going to be taxed on the gain. What happens in those years when the stock goes down? I hope you're going to be able to write those losses off. But we don't know the details yet, and Senator Van Hollen is looking forward to getting the details. And that line about the guardrails, but we don't have any details. We just got guardrails, but no details on the guardrails. So confused. It is 6:20. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We will be talking with Cheryl Atkison this morning. Jennifer Harper joins us from the Washington Times. Jim Trustee will be on board. Some developments in the Alex Murdaugh case. We've got KT McFarland on the way and Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. And, of course, the White House correspondent at Newsmax, John Gizzi. So an action-packed couple of hours here on the Saturday Morning Update. Right now, Mike Franciotti is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
You may encounter some off and on slowing along the outer loop as you approach the American Legion Bridge. They are in the process of picking up the cones there, so it looks like that work zone is picked up, but you still may encounter some off and on slowing the outer loop as you approach the American Legion Bridge coming into Virginia. No big issues. All the major interstates doing well. No issues on the Beltway in Maryland, Interstate 95 and the Parkway between both Beltways moving at speed. And Route 50 looks good both east and westbound between the Beltway and Faber. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Well, good Saturday morning. Temperatures starting off near freezing, and the winds are actually pretty gusty already. Northwest at 25 to 30 miles per hour. That means your wind chills in the low to mid-20s to start the day. We will see a little bit of sun this afternoon, but mostly cloudy, breezy conditions, and temperatures only climbing up to around 47 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
38 degrees in the nation's capital. It is 6:22 on a Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
And the Saturday Morning Update does continue. I'm Rick Fowler, and Vice President Harris has had some comments this week. She had a couple of them that made the headlines. You may have heard the ones about the environment, climate change, and mental health of children. We don't have time to get that one in, but this one kind of stood out to me where she's talking about conservatives. And what struck me about this is that apparently her mother was teaching her that conservatives are bad people. That's what struck me about this one. So check this out from our Vice President, Kamala Harris, this week.
We called it ecology at the time, and we talked about it in the context of conservation. In fact, I'm going to share with you a very simple story, which is that I went home one day and I said, well, why are conservatives bad, Mommy? Because I thought we were supposed to conserve things. I couldn't reconcile it. Now I can.
So that's Kamala Harris and being taught that conservatives are bad by her mom. It's clever. Yeah. 6:23, the Saturday Morning Update, and we've got some interesting comments from Jennifer Granholm, and we're going to get to those. That's coming up next. Stay with us here on the Saturday Morning Update. The Saturday Morning Update continues at 6:28, and Jennifer Granholm is our Secretary of Energy, and I always wonder where she gets her information from. You're familiar with SXSW, South by Southwest. It's a big conference they have in Austin, Texas every year. All the think tank people and tech people, everybody shows up at South by Southwest in Austin. Well, our Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm, was there. She was doing an interview, and she claimed that Americans can, quote, learn from what China is doing in combating climate change. That's right. She sang the praises of China for its efforts to reduce climate change, claiming the country is actually, quote, very sensitive about the issue, more so than the United States. This is from our Secretary of Energy. She made the claims despite the fact that China recently hit its coal production record last year. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, 55% of China's energy now comes from fossil fuel, compared to 11% in the United States. No idea where she gets her numbers. Well, speaking of numbers, you may have heard about the bank failure, as regulators had rushed on Friday to seize the assets of Silicon Valley Bank. It is a big tech lender. A lot of startup companies get their funding and place it with Silicon Valley Bank. And there was a run on the bank. It is the largest failure of such an institution since the height of the financial crisis in 2008. And it's a mess. Now, you may know that if the FDIC insurance kicks in, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, they will guarantee it up to $250,000. But if you had a venture capital investment there, or if you're a tech company and you had your money parked in there, anything over $250,000 is going to be a really big question mark. So for people that had millions of dollars held in that bank, and FDIC only covers you up to $250,000, that could be a problem. The dust will be settling, but it is a huge problem for a lot of investors and venture capitalists. So you're going to see an impact not only on those companies, but on tech in general. We already saw other bank stocks take a hit yesterday, and some of the tech startups will be taking hits as well as the venture capitalists. So that's the Silicon Valley Bank failure. It's 6:30, and we've got Mike Franciotti coming up at the WMAL Traffic Center.
At this time, no reports of any accidents or travel lanes blocked around the entire D.C. Beltway system. No problems between the Beltways, Interstate 95 approaching Sandy Springs, 198. You lose at least one lane there with road construction. No issues on the Parkway, Route 50 moving well, looking good along the I-270 corridor. Off and on slowing, going into Virginia from Maryland, crossing the American Legion Bridge as you make your way through that work zone. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Well, good Saturday morning. Temperatures starting off near freezing, and the winds are actually pretty gusty already. Northwest at 25 to 30 miles per hour. That means your wind chills in the low to mid-20s to start the day. We will see a little bit of sun this afternoon, but mostly cloudy, breezy conditions, and temperatures only climbing up to around 47 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
38 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:32, the Saturday morning update. The Saturday Morning Update continues. I'm Rick Fowler, and Jennifer Harper is with us. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and you can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Rick, and I'm pretty good.
Well, the president wants to spend some more money and tax the rich and the not-so-rich. So what's the reaction from the Republicans and then the media as well? Of course, he was in Philadelphia on Thursday with his big budget rollout.
Yeah, that was a big rollout, wasn't it? Well, let's review some of the numbers here. We're talking $6.8 trillion. And if you don't know what a trillion is, That has 12 zeros after it, so that's what we're talking about here. And here's just a couple of the reactions that came out. This is from National Public Radio. They said, Biden is using his budget as a cudgel in the debt ceiling fight. And for 2024, that word cudgel is really something, isn't it? Anyway, moving right along, CNN said Biden's budget lays groundwork for high-stakes battle ahead. Fox Business said Biden pitches soak the rich tax plan, and here's what in it. And Breitbart News said Biden's budget bonanza, big tax hikes, spending increases, mounting debt. And, you know, the Americans for Tax Reform, this is a nonprofit advocacy group. They really go into taxes in minute forms. But anyway, they said, to kind of summarize, if you don't know what's going on here, Biden raises the current 21% federal corporate income tax rate to 28%, higher than communist China's 25%.
Ooh.
Industry sectors of strategic use to the Chinese government pay a lower rate of 15% or even 10%. After adding state corporate income taxes, the combined federal-state rate under Biden amounts to about 32%. Again, that's coming from Americans for Tax Reform. And interesting reaction, too, from the Republican National Committee. They said, Joe Biden likes to say, show me your budget, and I'll tell you what you value. If you look at his budget, which is going to send our country $50 trillion into debt by 2033, it's clear what he values, and it's not you and your family. And Representative Roger Williams, he's a Texas Republican, he offered a great summary of the whole thing. He said Biden's budget shakes down small businesses to fund the liberal agenda. So that's your budget report for this morning.
Well, that's encouraging. How about the 2024 election? A lot of buzz about Ron DeSantis this past week. But how do the Americans feel about whether the president should go for it again?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because that buzz is starting to come up a little bit. You have to remember, too, and I did not know this, President Biden actually ran for president two times before. Once in 1987, again in 2007, and then after that, he became Barack Obama's choice for vice president. And that's all coming from Ballotpedia.com. That's a very interesting internet site. But anyway, the chatter keeps going on and on. And so there was a poll from the Associated Press, and it revealed that Democrats themselves are not so keen on Mr. Biden running again. And this is what they, an AP poll had to say. A majority of Democrats now think one term is plenty for President Joe Biden, despite his insistence that he plans to seek re-election in 2024. And poll, this is again an AP poll, it revealed that just 37% of Democrats say that they want him to seek a second term. Oh, my goodness. Well, anyway, an Economist YouGov poll also did not have particularly promising numbers for the president. It found that 57% of U.S. adults do not want Mr. Biden to vie for the highest office again. That includes 79% of Republicans, 62% of independents, and even 32% of Democrats. And that's a third of that. So a third of that group. And there are a couple of folks that do disagree. And on the other side of the fence, 26% of respondents, again, an Economist YouGov poll, 26% would like Mr. Biden to make another run for the White House. So we don't know yet, but that's what's going on.
So there have been some stories floating around out there of some people who have called for a separation of the United States by their political beliefs. How's that going over?
Well, that's a distressing thing for a whole lot of people, particularly because they call it a national divorce. And certainly I think a lot of people think about that every now and then. But there's our friends over at The Economist YouGov made a poll about this one this week also. And they discovered that almost half of Americans, 47% of U.S. adults, strongly disagree with the following statement. We need a national divorce. We need to separate by red states and blue states. So almost half of all adults strongly disagree with that. 16% somewhat disagree with that statement. 15% slightly disagree with that statement. 15% are not sure, but a mere 7% strongly agree with the statement. So not very popular out there. It's a sort of a hair-raising group of words there. National divorce, meh. But anyway, a lot of people don't like it. And again, that's coming from economist and YouGov poll.
You know, it seems as though the only time you hear about the troubled Southwest border is on the Fox News Channel and on conservative talk radio. But there are some other reporters, and there is a reason we may not see those stories here in the U.S.
That's right, because this is becoming a global story. And I found a very interesting account, probably the most interesting account of the week, from Deutsche Welle. I probably mispronounced that, or it's called DW. This is a major German news organization. This was published this week. This was the account that they covered, and I did not see anything about this with American news organizations, but here's what they say. Authorities in Mexico found an abandoned truck carrying 103 unaccompanied minors, making it the biggest discovery of migrant children traveling through Mexico in recent times. The minors were traveling without adult relatives and were part of a group of 343 migrants of Central and South America. This is according to the National Migration Institute. Again, this is a German news organization reporting this. They continue, along with the migrant children, authorities also found 212 adults from Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Ecuador in the trailer, and another 28 migrants were found traveling as families in the vehicle. That's really crowded. The migrants were found safe, wearing color-coded bracelets that were apparently used for identifying them as smugglers' clients. And they also, the German news organization also noted that the truck was found without a driver. I mean, yikes. So that's your news of the week coming from Germany.
Well, with the number of people coming across the border that we don't know too much about, and with the fentanyl problem in this country, and what we just saw in Matamoros with the U.S. tourists, people could be a little concerned about security and safety. And you've got a place to go.
Yes, indeed. If you want some very interesting weekend reading and for later on in the week, too, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has released the 2023 Annual Threat Assessment of the United States Intelligence Community. Here is what their office said in a statement. This report reflects the collective insights of the intelligence community, which is committed every day to providing the nuanced, independent, and unvarnished intelligence that policymakers, war fighters, and domestic law enforcement personnel need to protect lives and American interests anywhere in the world. This is a 40-page unclassified assessment. And guess what, Rick? It's available to download for free. Great idea. The National Intelligence Council stands ready to support policymakers with additional information in an unclassified setting. This is, again, from the report. If you were curious about that, and I certainly was, you can go to their website. Again, this is the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. It is odni.gov. Again, odni.gov. All you got to do is click on the newsroom. They've got reports and publications. And last time I checked, it was still sitting right there at their landing page. But interesting reading and possibly helpful.
You know, there was a time when the Oscars were a huge deal to the television audience, maybe not quite as much as they used to be, but they've always had those goodie bags, those little gift bags that the actors get at the Oscars. Tell us what's going on in those goodie bags.
Oh, my goodness. Well, yes, indeed. They're actually called swag bags, Rick. I've never gotten a swag bag lately. Probably never will, but that's okay. Anyway, someone has done a very in-depth study about not only what's in the swag bags, but how much they're worth. And actually, this is coming from Forbes, and certainly for Monetary Matters, they're a very good source. And they have created the Swag Bag Index. And what they have done, yes, I love that. Anyway, they're tracking the hefty costs that are associated with the gift bags that are handed out to all the celebrities during the Academy Awards. Again, that's on Sunday. And here's just a couple of things that are in the bags, or certificates of them, perhaps. The gifts include a getaway to an exclusive retreat in Canada, or another getaway at a renovated lighthouse off the coast of Italy. Another is a gift certificate for plastic surgery. Another for anti-aging treatments and other things like that. And they say that the total amount that was spent on this year's haul, this is according to Forbes, is worth an estimated $126,000.
Yikes.
For the gift goodie bags. Anyway, this is actually a 10% drop from last year. Oh, my gosh. And nearly half of the all-time high of $225,000 in 2020. And again, Forbes says, the bag is still worth more than 300 times the value of Oscar the statue himself. That is a 24-karat gold-plated statuette. Only cost $400 to make, and that's the Forbes conclusion in the swag bag index, Rick.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway, The Washington Times. And as I said before, you can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Rick. Have a good weekend, everybody.
And you too. And a reminder, daylight saving time tonight, so you'll set the clocks an hour forward. Mike Franciotti is in the WML Traffic Center. Then we're back with Jim Trusty.
In Virginia, northbound 95, as you approach the Springfield Interchange, we've got what looks like a disabled vehicle. It's on the left-hand side of the roadway, traffic getting by relatively easily to the right. No issue southbound on 95 between Springfield and Fredericksburg. You are looking good. 395 moving well. No issues along Interstate 66. The Maryland Beltway, no reports of any issues. 95 in the Parkway between the Beltways looking good. Wide open along Route 50 between the Capitol Beltway and Bay Bridge. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, WMAL Storm Watch 7 forecast.
Well, good Saturday morning. Temperatures starting off near freezing, and the winds are actually pretty gusty already. Northwest at 25 to 30 miles per hour. That means your wind chills in the low to mid-20s to start the day. We will see a little bit of sun this afternoon, but mostly cloudy, breezy conditions, and temperatures only climbing up to around 47 degrees. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
38 degrees. We're at 6:45 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us. He is a member of the Trump legal team and a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
A couple of twists in the Murdaugh family murder investigations down in South Carolina. And one of them is that Alex Murdaugh's attorneys did announce that they would appeal. From what you've seen of the grounds for appeal, do you think they've got any place to go with that?
Well, there certainly is going to be an appeal, and there'll be argument and resolution of that in the higher court. But really, there's only one issue that strikes me as having any legs, and that's the issue of bringing into evidence Alex's financial crimes. And there's really different philosophies state to state about how acceptable that other crimes evidence is. I would say this. In this case, the judge literally had testimony, not just a proffer where the attorneys talked about what the evidence would look like, but the judge put the witnesses on the stand outside the presence of the jury, which is a little bit of an unusual step, but it's a good one for appellate purposes because it means this judge was being very careful and used his discretion, and that's really the key for the appeal. Did he abuse discretion? But he used discretion in having his own little mini trial and then ruling that it was going to be admissible as part of the motive for the homicides that took place. So I think ultimately he's going to be on pretty solid grounds, but you never know exactly which judges you're going to get and how they're going to view other crimes evidence.
So the father is Alex, and we know he was convicted. Help us out on the sons, because there's one son who is deceased, but the other son, Buster, who we saw in the courtroom, he was the topic of some major news on Friday.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time keeping up with all the homicidal allegations around the Murdaugh family. We certainly knew about the allegations for the trial where Alex was convicted of killing his wife and his son, Paul. And part of what he did in his defense was suggest that Paul's involvement in a drunk boating accident, which ended up killing a young girl on a pier, his girlfriend, that was somehow the motive, that there was a retaliatory, vigilante, anti-drunk boating crew that was trying to take out their vengeance on the Murdaugh family. It obviously fell very flat. So we knew about Paul having the drunk boating accident. The news that I hadn't really seen before was when the lead prosecutor this week from Alex's trial vowed to go down, as he called it, every single rabbit hole involving the Murdaugh family. And the rabbit hole that I initially thought this would be about, and I think it probably is part of the equation, was the death of the housekeeper who fell on the stairs in 2018, Gloria Satterfield. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. This was one of Alex's many financial crimes, if nothing else, because he collected, he and his law school chum, who represented the Satterfield estate, collected $4.3 million in wrongful death settlement proceeds, while the children, the heirs, got nothing. So the two opposing attorneys, and I guess I'd put opposing in quotes, somehow decided that they would file the claim, collect from the insurance company, and split the $4.3 million between themselves, which was obviously kind of Exhibit A for financial crimes by Alex. So that one has always been intriguing, this mysterious fall that nobody witnessed and a speedy non-autopsy burial and all sorts of other circumstances that suggest Alex was up to no good. The news story that came out from this rabbit hole pledge from the prosecutor was about Buster, as you said, the redheaded son that was in court that was accused of surreptitiously giving the middle finger during some of the testimony he didn't like. And Buster had a 19-year-old classmate by the name of Stephen Smith who was found dead on a country road, with law enforcement basically saying, and I think this was about three or four years ago, saying that he must have been hit by a car. Now, the attorney for the Smith family says there is no reason to believe there was a hit-and-run automobile collision. There was no broken glass. His shoes were on. There was head trauma and nothing else, nothing that suggested a vehicle-to-pedestrian accident. But there's also not anything that I'm seeing publicly that ties Buster to it. So there's a lot behind the scenes on this one, and it's very interesting that it's kind of bubbling up to the surface with yet another Murdaugh family and another inexplicable dead body associated with it. So we'll keep an eye on it. Now, I will say this, Rick. You know, the Murdaugh family has certainly earned some scrutiny, but to be consistent, at least how I view the criminal justice system, I have to say I'm not really wild about prosecutors announcing targets. You know, they should let the indictments and the court proceedings do the talking. If they want to say, you know, we want to look into any sort of suspicious death and have resolution, that's fine. But this idea of saying we're going to get every Murdaugh that we can, which is kind of the theme of that rabbit hole remark, is not something I'm in love with. And I can tell you, I don't respect it when I see New York prosecutors announcing they're going to run for office on the idea of indicting Donald Trump. I'm not going to like it when, you know, a South Carolina prosecutor just takes it upon themselves to impugn others within that family.
I want to turn to Alec Baldwin. New York Post reporting Friday, Alec Baldwin drew one step closer to trial. What were the developments this week?
Yeah, small things, but interesting in terms of the squalor. In the Baldwin matter, the relationship between the defense attorneys and the prosecutors looks to be on life support. They are not getting along. The defense announced the other day that state investigators had destroyed the gun that was involved in the shooting, the very crux of the manslaughter prosecution. And you have to step back and recognize, you know, Alec Baldwin's statements, some of which on TV, were basically saying the gun was the problem, that the mechanical condition of that gun was the issue in terms of why it discharged. And there may be experts, I think, on both sides that will dispute that. That one side, the defense, will say this was essentially a hair trigger firearm, Baldwin didn't do anything negligent, and most likely a state investigator, a gun expert, who will say, wait a minute, he had to have had his hand on the trigger or he had to have cocked it, and he did something that volitionally caused this thing to discharge. So it's a big centerpiece of the case, that condition of the gun. It's not totally unusual for testing to cause harm. And in this case, the state prosecutor said there is no destroyed gun, but the FBI firearms testing did, in fact, damage some internal components. So in a sense, both sides are right and both sides are wrong. it's not insignificant that the testing damaged the components of the gun, but it's also not destroyed. So they're going to fight over that for a while. The bottom line is the trial goes on. The condition of the evidence after testing may be good stuff for the defense to play with at trial, but it doesn't suddenly end the prosecution. There's lots of cases or trials that go to court even after the drugs or bullets or things have been destroyed, either negligently or just because it took so long to go to trial. So this won't be a huge issue that it happened, but the defense will play with it. And what we found out this week was that they are going to have a preliminary hearing on May 3rd. The prosecutor gave a list of 46 potential witnesses. And remember, a preliminary hearing is not a jury trial. It's just the judge determining probable cause as to whether the case should be bound over for trial. In other words, whether there's enough to proceed to trial. For the rest of us out here, it's going to be a fascinating preview of evidence. If the prosecutor is going to call, you know, any sizable subset of those 46 witnesses, we're going to get a pretty deep look at the strength of the case and the weaknesses of the case long before a jury gets impaneled.
Jim, I saw a story maybe 10 days or so ago about the money that George Soros has spent on electing progressive prosecutors all over the United States. And you've got some interesting information for us on that.
Yeah, I found an opinion piece that finally trotted out a good number of actual contribution amounts. You know, we hear about George Soros funding progressive prosecutors around the country. And the initial hook in this story, by the way, was describing Janae Edmondson, the young woman we talked about last week who lost her legs to a violent felon who never should have been out on the streets driving a car. So they start with the Edmondson story, but then it goes on to talk about how Soros has spent nearly $40 million to help district and circuit attorneys that he supports. And, of course, he only supports from one side of the aisle, and it's to the far left side of that aisle. Some of the contributions made up between 80 and 90% of the entire campaign funding for people like Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. He gave $1 million to Krasner, and homicides have gone up 60%. Since Krasner took office. He gave lots of money to $2.5 million, to be more precise, to George Cascone in Los Angeles, 45% increase in homicides. Alvin Bragg apparently got millions of dollars, and, of course, the New York crime scene is pretty devastating. And Soros donated thousands, at least, maybe not more than that, but thousands to Kimberly Gardner, the St. Louis progressive prosecutor under siege for her negligence in allowing Janae Edmondson to be so grievously harmed in that St. Louis incident. So it was interesting to see some real numbers attached to some of the progressive prosecutors around the country. The thing I would also just emphasize is when you're talking about a local DA, Commonwealth attorney, state's attorney's office race, $500,000 or $1 million is huge money. I mean, that is the difference between one candidate having TV spots and the other one relying on word of mouth and local newspaper. And so, you know, this is the kind of investment by Soros that seems to be paying off, because what seems like a little amount of money for him is a huge contribution, like I said, sometimes between 80 and 90% of the entire campaign's funding that's helping get these elected officials into office that almost to a man or woman seem to be harming the communities they're supposed to serve.
One last one, Jim. We heard about the financial crimes of Alex Murdaugh, but he's not the only lawyer down south that's had a little chicanery going on.
Well, and let's start with a disclaimer. I went to law school in Atlanta, so I love the South and I love Georgia. But we have a second player in the story from Georgia lawyers, a man named Nathan Hardwick. But Nathan was the former managing partner of a Georgia law firm. He gave up his law license this week. He had been convicted several years ago of stealing $26 million from his firm. When he pled guilty to stealing that $26 million, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Atlanta issued a statement that Nathan Hardwick spent the stolen money on gambling, private jets, and more than 50 different social companions. And to me, it reminds me of the very often imitated quote first attributed to W.C. Field, where he said, "I spent half my money on gambling, alcohol, and wild women, and I wasted the rest." Nathan Hardwick brought back one of the greater quotes that I can remember this week with his disbarment.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And you too. 6:58, Saturday morning update. Daylight saving time tonight. Move that clock ahead 1 hour. We've got 7 o'clock news coming up next with Heather Curtis. Then it's John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkinson, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and KT McFarland all on the way.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.